This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. The podcast Trade-Offs recently launched their third season. It's a show focused on unpacking some of the many complexities and unintended consequences found within the healthcare industry. With us now are two of the folks behind the podcast, founder and executive editor Dan Gorenstein and reporter-producer Ryan Levy. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Miriam.
Dan, I'll start with you. As one of the founders of this podcast, can you tell us how it all got started?
Sure. I was a healthcare reporter for the public radio business show Marketplace for 6 years. And Miriam, I was really struck ultimately as I talked to more and more people, how folks in positions of power, decision makers, lawmakers, industry executives, large employers lacked basic information, basic evidence about how the complicated world of healthcare actually worked. I got to spend a lot of my time talking to all these academics who really spent their time studying and analyzing evidence and data, asking these pioneering questions. And a lot of the time you have these large employers who are buying insurance for employees, lawmakers, and industry leaders, you know, noses down doing the daily work, and they didn't really have time to access all of this incredible information, this evidence, and instead often would make decisions based on gut instinct or political views. And I decided that maybe it would be good to have a podcast that could really help inform those decision makers with better information so they could really make smarter decisions that impact so many of us.
Did you accomplish what you set out to do? Because, I mean, you're on another season now. So I'm curious if you felt like there's been some changes.
Yeah, I mean, fair question. Healthcare in the United States is still a mess. I think we can all pretty much fairly agree that that's the case, despite the fact that Trade-Offs has produced 140 different episodes, 140 plus episodes at this point. But I do, Miriam, think that we're making inroads. I think that we've had several lawmakers, actually a state lawmaker from Indiana, in response to one of our shows, reached out with a text or a tweet or something saying, thanks for this story. It really helps me think about health policy more. We get philanthropic support from institutions as well as individuals. And one of those individuals is a state senator in Colorado. I think there are lots of signs that these decision makers are, in fact, listening to our work and taking it in. And I think one of the ways that we've tried to do it, which is really in the best tradition of public radio, is combine rigorous reporting, evidence and data, right, with that context and the storytelling, trying to understand the human beings that are really at the intersection of policy, health policy, money, and people. And I think signs are that that is resonating with our audience.
Ryan, what's your role? How did you get involved into producing this show and reporting for it? And what drew you to it?
Yeah, so I was moving on from, I had worked at the public radio station in San Francisco, Bay Area, KQED, for a few years, and was moving across the country to DC to start something new, and was, you know, looking for any and all different kinds of reporting jobs that I could do. And one of my former editors connected me with Dan and said, hey, this guy has a healthcare podcast that he's starting, and I think you should talk to him. And Dan and I think we had a quick phone conversation and talked with a couple other people on the team. And then Dan was down in DC where I'd moved, and we walked around DC for like 2 hours talking about the show, about his vision for the show, what my role might be. And it was just really clear that he was trying to do something really cool and trying to take this, this super important part of our society that touches all of us. But that is also incredibly complicated, and so few of us really understand, trying to take that and make it more accessible for the people who need to understand it. And really, as he said, combine that, that public radio storytelling that we all love and that can kind of help us connect with complex issues, but also really grounding it in that evidence and that data so we can kind of move past talking points and silver bullet ideas about what's going to fix the system. And so it was a vision that was really appealing, and the idea of also working on something brand new, kind of building something from the ground up, was exciting to me. I was not a healthcare person. I didn't have that in my background. I was learning along with all of our audience about all of these issues, but it was really exciting and kind of jumped right in. And within the first couple of weeks was producing one of our first stories on hospital consolidation and the impacts that has had on our system. And so has really been kind of an on-the-job learning as I've gone through this, now 2.5 years into this, working on all sorts of stories.
And Miriam, to jump on a point that Ryan made about not being a healthcare reporter, when I started at Marketplace, I wasn't a healthcare reporter. I really didn't know, honestly, much of the difference between Medicare, the program that's for older Americans, and Medicaid, the program that provides care to disabled and low-income Americans. And one of the cool things for me, like I was told, like I didn't even want to be a healthcare reporter. I thought the idea of being a healthcare reporter seemed silly because every story was basically like, the healthcare system screwed up. It's really expensive. We all know that. And no one knows how to fix it. The end. Mm-hmm. Like, what's the point of doing those stories again and again and again? But this opportunity to work for Marketplace as a member station reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio which was really attractive to me. And I sort of dove in with both feet, and it was happening right around the time of the Affordable Care Act launching. And I came to learn how nuanced, how subtle, how important, and how vital healthcare policy was. And pretty soon, I mean, it definitely took me a while, but I started to learn stuff. And I thought to myself, well, if somebody like me, who doesn't really know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid, can learn, then lots of people can learn. And one of the things that was startling, you know, I'd put so many of these people in healthcare on a pedestal, like docs and nurses and hospital executives and pharmaceutical executives and policymakers. But it was really eye-opening and important to realize that even though they had expertise in certain areas, they lacked expertise in other areas. And these people in some ways were felt just as lost as I did. And I was like, damn, that's pretty real. How can we provide better information? And it's not like there's not good healthcare journalism out there. Like, in no way do I want to make that case, right? There's amazing healthcare journalism that's being produced every single day. The problem is it's not getting to enough people. And so one of the thoughts behind the idea was, can we kind of do like the best, what public radio I think does best, which is this amazing contextualized explainer storytelling type journalism, you know, This American Life, Radio Lab, shows like that, that really can unpack these complicated stories and sort of sneak in the policy and the wonky, but do it in a way that like makes you learn. And I thought, well, if we could create something approximating that, then maybe more people could actually learn, not just those decision makers, but all of us. And so that really is like this stems from my own humility around this issue and my own recognition that everybody actually can learn, and there's a lot to be gained and a lot that we can apply. And I'll just say one last thing. I know I've been going on, I apologize, but one final thing that was a little bit of no pun intended here, a little bit of a nail in the coffin for me about this idea was my dad died. He had ALS, and he suffered for 3.5 years, and is really tough to watch this happen up close. But one of the things that was amazing about it was that because I was a healthcare reporter, I was able to play a bit more of a lead role in helping my dad and stepmom navigate a truly, truly miserable time in their lives. And I couldn't have done that if I hadn't been a healthcare reporter. I had more confidence about how to navigate the healthcare system. And I know that's something that intimidates so many of us. And so I wanted in some way to share that with other people, to share that power with people, because I think it's important. And I know, obviously, it's silly to say, but it's so true. Healthcare does, and one time or another, will touch every single one of us.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And I appreciate that the transparency in the way that the show is structured for everyone to be able to understand what's going on. And especially when you mentioned that the decision makers are also being targeted to learn about what's going on. I think that because it's such a complex system, so many of us tune it out or hope that someone will come along and explain it to us.
Totally, totally. I remember the first time I picked up the magazine, The New Yorker, and I don't remember what the topic was, but I read it and I was like, oh wow, I've been wondering about this topic for a decade, and now someone just broke it down to me, and I feel like I got a lot smarter after, you know, 45 minute read. And that really opened my eyes personally to the power of journalism, what journalism could do. And certainly we are Trade-Offs are just trying to do that for people too.
And Ryan, before we go to break real quick, what are some of the topics that you've been covering lately?
So I've been covering a lot. I mean, just this year we have covered harm reduction and drug policy, which I know we're going to touch on a little more later. We did a look at, you talked about kind of these topics can be so kind of challenging and complex. We did a story on the complicated ways that the FDA is financed and how it's paid and how actually a good chunk of their financing comes from fees from the corporations, the pharmaceutical companies that they regulate. And we knew that that would be kind of a tough sell for most people. So we did it in kind of a Super Bowl themed episode to try and make that a little more interesting. So lots of different topics. And we try to, you know, make it palatable and interesting for folks to dive in.
Well, we'll definitely touch upon those when we come back from the break. We're talking with two of the people behind Trade-Offs, a podcast about the healthcare industry. If you have any questions or comments, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about just a few of the ever complicated issues surrounding healthcare in America with two of the people behind the podcast Trade-Offs, which recently launched its third season. With us are Trade-Offs founder and executive editor Dan Gorenstein and reporter-producer Ryan Levy. Ryan, I want to talk about what we kind of touched on before the break, a recent episode you did focused on harm reduction. What does that phrase mean within the context of this story?
Yeah, so harm reduction in the kind of story was around drug policy. And the idea is for, you know, 50 years of U.S. drug policy, the focus in the U.S. has really been, you know, drug policy has really been a criminal issue and more recently a medical issue, something to treat and try to solve, a problem to solve. And this idea of harm reduction is this philosophy that, you know, the main goal is not necessarily to get someone or the immediate goal is not necessarily to get someone to stop using drugs. The immediate goal is to reduce the amount of harm that person is experiencing. And so that could mean, and often does mean helping them continue to use drugs, but do it in a more safe way. And that's where we get to things like needle exchanges or syringe service programs, where folks get clean needles to inject drugs, and even more kind of advanced or more further down the line examples, such as supervised consumption sites, where it is actually a place where folks can come bring their own drugs and actually use their drugs under supervision of medical professionals who are there in case they overdose or have any issues. So again, it's really this idea that trying to make it safer for folks to use drugs, as opposed to immediately saying the immediate goal has to be stop using drugs.
Mm-hmm. And there's I know there's some controversy surrounding that. We've done some episodes of this show with folks working on these needle exchange programs or having places where they've completely eliminated them. But in terms of this particular story or this episode that you focused on with harm reduction, Dan, what made you decide to focus on this topic from this specific angle versus taking it on from another angle?
Well, you know, this was Ryan's idea, and Ryan had seen a safe consumption site in New York City open. I can't remember if it was December or it was right around the new year. And the Biden administration was making this very interesting decision of letting it go federal law forbids these safe consumption sites from running. And ostensibly a safe consumption site is a place where a person who uses drugs can go and use an illegal drug, and they are going to be safe. They'll be overseen. They potentially can be hooked up to additional services, but it's a way, you know, it's a physical space that says, hey, if you're going to use drugs, go here. That is that, and you'll be okay. We're going to take care of you. If you overdose, we've got things. And if it gets real bad, we'll call the medical professionals in. And, you know, the Biden administration said, we're cool with this. The Trump administration had cracked down on a site that was supposed to open in Philadelphia. And so Ryan said to me, hey, Dan, look at this. This is pretty interesting. This is different. And that began us doing what we typically do at Trade-Offs, which is really try to say, how can we advance the conversation? How can we kind of give people some good information, some good context, and a little bit of storytelling so they can really sort of appreciate this moment and why this particular episode matters? And so, Ryan, I'd throw it over to you to sort of like to take it from there. How did we then kind of like shape and mold this?
Yeah, and I think, you know, from there, it was really kind of trying to identify who are the people who we need to hear from in this story. You know, we really wanted to hear from obviously experts. So there's a lot of talking to researchers and folks on the ground who are doing this work, who can kind of say, you know, how are people in this movement reacting to the administration's response here? What does the evidence say about these various harm reduction techniques that are becoming more popular? And how can we make this, you know, as Dan mentioned, you know, I think the storytelling, like how can we make this really feel personal to folks and have them understand, you know, what this feels from like a human level. And so it really is just a process of kind of, you know, casting a wide net on a topic like this and trying to get a sense of what's happening now, who is doing what now, what do policymakers need to be thinking about, and what evidence is out there to inform their thinking, and how can we bring that all together in a way that, as Dan said, is going to move the conversation forward.
Well, Ryan, at the beginning of the episode, you play two clips of Joe Biden talking about drug use, one from 1989 and one from 2021. Can you sort of tell us what he was saying in each and what that illustrates with the striking dichotomy between the two?
Yeah. So, as you said, 1989, that was Senator Joe Biden back then. And this is, you know, the height of both the, you know, kind of what people think of as a crime wave. The HIV crisis is happening at this time, as well as a lot of drug use. And so the kind of the war on drugs is really in full swing at this time. And, you know, in that 1989 clip, Joe Biden is really saying, you know, we have to hold drug users accountable. You know, this is something that, you know, if there aren't drug users, there are no drugs and we don't have a problem. So he's really talking about, you know, placing the blame on the folks who are using illegal drugs. And then you fast forward to 2021 and it's a much, you know, kind of calmer, gentler Joe Biden, President Joe Biden at this point. And he's saying, you know, the tone is incredibly different. He's saying, you know, to those who are still struggling, I want you to know that I see you. We're going to beat this thing together. It's a much more conciliatory and approach. And it's one that says, you know, this is, we have kind of a shared problem. Like, you are struggling with something and we're going to work together to help you through it. And so it really signifies this shift from, you know, really placing blame and responsibility on the drug user and saying, this is your problem, you need to fix this, to saying, we know that this is really bigger than you, and we are here to support you, and we want to help you get through it. And so that's definitely a change that we have seen, as we have seen a growth in interest in treatment for drug addiction, and in treating drug addiction more as a medical problem as opposed to a moral failing. But I will also say, and I'm sure we'll get into this more, you know, that is not everyone subscribes to that change. You know, that is a change we have seen, but certainly that has not happened across the board.
If you're listening live and have any questions or comments on the topic today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That number again is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Tradeoffs founder and executive editor Dan Gorenstein and reporter producer Ryan Levy. Dan, the rhetoric of drug use has changed maybe with some public figures, but how does it look for the general public? Are ideas shifting at all?
Well, I think they are. And I think COVID has played a real role in putting mental health on the map in a way that it has never been on the map in my lifetime. I'm 47 years old. And I think, you know, in your question that you asked Ryan a couple of seconds ago, Miriam, like playing these two different clips of the president of the United States, this kind of like, we got to crack down on illegal drug use, to like, we're going to get through this together. I mean, I think Biden is channeling, that's not just the president. I think there are lots of people, lots of officials who are beginning to wrap their arms around this idea that the previous 50 years of tough on drug use hasn't really worked. The problem's gotten worse. So maybe it's time to try something different. And so, you know, I think these are small little steps, but something that we flagged on our website, like Ryan put together, did a masterful job of like, if you're really interested in this issue, and I'm not just like plugging, I'm not plugging our website. If you care about this issue, you should go to our website and see what Ryan's done. He's really laid things out in a super clean, clear way. And in preparation for the interview, I wanted to kind of go back and refresh. And the Biden administration's done a couple of small things that you could see beginning to put seeds in the ground, right? Like, they've set aside $30 million in federal grants that are earmarked for specifically just harm reduction. These are grants that can go to states. These can go to local governments. These can go to nonprofits. So that's $30 million that's doing some work. And I'm not pretending that $30 million is a lot. It's not, but it's something. It's a start. State and local governments now can, for the first time, use federal money for fentanyl test strips. These are ways to test and see if the drugs that you're using are laced with fentanyl, which has been a chemical that's been shown to increase overdose and deaths. And, you know, I think the administration sent a big message by not cracking down on this safe consumption site in New York. So these are all little small signals that something is shifting, that substance use is different. I mean, drug user used to be a dirty word, and now people don't say that as much. They say substance use or substance abuse. It's, I think, something shifting. I, not to put you in a bad place, Miriam, but what do you think based on the reporting you've done?
I mean, what I'm wondering, though, is if the shifting has been due to politics, you know, trying to appeal to a changed audience of folks who are more aware of what's going on and are more open to talking about stuff, younger generations. So I wonder if that's part of it.
I think.
Ryan, sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there is. I mean, I think a big change, and we talked about this in the story, and I think this has happened both at the policymaker level as well as the kind of the populist level, is really as we've seen, you know, the prescription opioid crisis unfold. And so in, you know, in a lot of, through the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, for a lot of people, drug use and people who were addicted to drugs, that was somebody else's problem. That was somebody else's world. And they didn't really have the empathy to say, we should really care for these people and help these people. Whereas when you start to see, huge numbers of people across the country, especially huge numbers of white people across the country, start to see in themselves, in their families, in their friends, in their communities, people struggling with drug addiction, people dying from overdoses, that was really a wake-up call for a lot of people who saw, when their loved one is struggling with addiction and they see that there's no treatment facility to send them to, when they see that other people around them turn on them and start treating the person that they love like a stranger and like someone not deserving of compassion and care and treatment, that has really at this large scale started to change people's minds and be like, oh my goodness, we need to change how we treat folks. These are still human beings. These are still people who are struggling. And I think there have been public officials who have talked about, this changed my mind. My son, my daughter, my husband, my wife, they struggled with this. They died from an overdose. We need to change how this system works. And so I think that kind of growing empathy and growing, unfortunately, that this through this tragic way of just more people knowing people who are struggling with addiction has created more empathy. And the fact that a lot of those people are white has taken, drug use for many people was seen as, a black problem for many years, which kind of added to the distance and added to the disinterest in treating it as a medical condition and treating folks with empathy and kindness and respect. And so mm-hmm. this shift in who is, suffering from addiction and seeing this firsthand, I think has had a huge impact both on policymakers as well as the people that they represent.
Well, Ryan, before we get to break real quick, I know there's a soundbite we wanted to hear from your podcast that features someone named Ricky. Can you tell us real quick who he is before we go into the clip?
Sure. Yeah. So Ricky Bluthenthal, he is now a professor at the University of Southern California. But at the time that he's talking about in his story, he's, a new researcher working with people who inject drugs in Oakland. And this is in the late 80s, early 90s, at the height of the HIV AIDS crisis. And he's seen the people he works with, tons of them be getting sick and dying from HIV and AIDS. And he's seen just a complete lack of response or interest from policymakers in doing anything to help these folks.
I wasn't willing to exist in a world where I knew this was happening and not do something to try and prevent it.
So Ricky helped start a needle exchange where people could get fresh syringes, making it less likely they'd share infected needles. This was one of the earliest examples of harm reduction in the U.S., Dan, and was also illegal.
I think we got arrested probably 10 to 15 times for operating the program, but we just wouldn't stop.
Wait, he got arrested for running a needle exchange?
That's right. In the late 70s, the Carter administration convinced most states to make handing out needles for drug use a crime, which meant that when needle exchanges like Ricky's started popping up in the 80s, early 90s, they were breaking the law. And even in states where these exchanges were legal, Congress wanted to limit their spread and preemptively banned federal funding for them in 1988.
Let me get this straight. You've got all these drug users out there getting AIDS, and you've got folks like Ricky trying to protect them by giving them clean needles. And policymakers' response is to say, we're not going to help you. We might even arrest you.
Pretty much. And so that's really, at this time, I mean, I think that really speaks to the change that we've seen. These efforts, these harm reduction efforts, really from the start have been viewed incredibly skeptically and even critically by policymakers. And as we've been talking about, that has started to change. There's more openness to these. But again, like I mentioned before, it's not a straight line. As y'all know better than us, Indiana has, kind of gone back and forth in terms of openness to needle exchanges with, the exchange that opened and then closed in Scott County. And even recently, You know, Dan mentioned that $30 million that the Biden administration is putting out for harm reduction. That has become enmeshed in controversy and has led some, you know, Democratic and Republican members of Congress to push to reinstate bans on funding for certain types of harm reduction, including needle exchanges. So this is something that is definitely kind of inching toward more acceptance, but certainly is far from kind of complete acceptance.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the healthcare industry with two people from the podcast Trade-Offs. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're spending the hour today with two of the people behind Trade-Offs, a podcast focused on issues surrounding the healthcare industry that recently launched its third season. We're joined by founder and executive editor Dan Gorenstein and reporter-producer Ryan Levy. Dan, we were just talking about harm reduction around drug use, and I want to also talk about some of the other stories that you've done. You've made a special series on a new mental health crisis line. What is this line that we're talking about here?
Sure. The new line is 988. And it in October 2020, Congress, I mean, this was right before the presidential election. COVID stuff was swirling. Like, I certainly didn't hear about it. I don't know if many people did. But Congress created 988. It's a new three-digit number that anyone in the U.S. or the territories can call for help in a mental health crisis. They pass this, and basically the law converts the existing National Suicide Prevention Lifeline from what is currently 10 digits down to just these 3988. But this is not a new suicide lifeline. This is, Congress wanted this number to be a lot more than that. And, you know, we say it like this in the story, they saw it as a front door for people in all kinds of mental health crises.
And Ryan, what do you think prompted the creation of this line? I mean, it sounds like, Dan, you're saying it's basically sort of transferring you to the line of the original hotline with some other added things.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I would defer to Dan a little bit on some of the kind of the background, but I think, you know, mental health is an issue that has become more and more a focus of regular folks as well as policymakers. We're seeing, you know, even before the pandemic, mental health was a growing crisis that we were hearing. Certainly, you know, in our reporting, we were hearing a lot about in terms of, you know, not having enough mental health clinicians and treatment opportunities for folks. And the pandemic has made all of those problems even worse with just all the, you know, when we've all just been living through such a challenging time. And so I think there's a recognition that, you know, folks need to be able to access mental health services more easily. And I think this number, you know, a simple, easy three-digit number, that could connect you to, you know, whatever kind of, ideally could connect you to whatever kind of service or help you need, was seen as something that could really help in this moment.
Right. On that point, you know, more than 130,000 people, you know, we were talking about harm reduction before the break, 130, you could look at sort of the creation of 988 as another example of potentially of harm reduction. Like 130,000 people combined died from suicide or overdose. And I think like in 2020, I've got that data point wrong. Sorry about that. But you have, not only do you have all these people dying from suicide or overdose, you also have, according to the Washington Post, police have fatally shot more than 1,500 people with mental illness in just the last 6 years. And so there's a real crisis. And I think there's some optimism, there's some hope, Miriam, that 988 is going to, in fact, really spur more people to get help in 2020. The Suicide Prevention Lifeline got 3 million calls, texts, and chats. And some federal officials estimate that that could quadruple to 12 million in just the first year. I don't know that it will, but like we're talking millions more people potentially getting access to services here. It's on its face, theoretically, this is a game changer. And I use that understanding that it's a cliche and a bit of an eye roll, but I think it actually is. It's got some of that possibility.
Ryan, how common is it for people experiencing a mental health crisis to call 911 instead of another hotline?
Dan may have more on kind of some of the specifics there. I mean, I do know that, you know, Dan had that number about, you know, the number of folks who've been fatally shot by police with the mental illness. You know, that's one in four of people fatally shot by police overall had a mental illness. And we see, you know, 44% of people in jail report a history of mental illness. So clearly we are seeing mental illness get subsumed and often kind of offloaded into our criminal justice system. And I think that's one of the issues that in theory 988 is really designed to prevent. And this idea that, you know, police and law enforcement are not the ones who are best trained or equipped to help people in the middle of a mental health crisis. And so if we can provide, you know, another number that folks can call that can connect them to more suitable services, we can help a lot more people and avoid some of the really tragic consequences we see when folks suffering from mental illness are met by law enforcement.
A really important point here is that for people of color, getting law enforcement involved can be a very dangerous thing. Black people currently today are more than twice as likely to be fatally shot by police compared to white people. And when you add mental illness into that, a black person's risk of being killed by police quadruples. And so in the big questions, Miriam, are, okay, so you've got this line, 988 goes live in July. I think it's July 16th. And in some places, actually, 988 is live right now, but in many places, it is not. And so there are three sort of big questions that need to be answered. Who's going to be answering these calls? Where will callers in crisis go if they need to go somewhere that's not just a phone call? And how's all of this work going to actually be funded? And what we're trying to do with our 988 coverage is begin to explore some of these foundational questions. If you talk to people who are excited about 988, they're going to say to you that potentially you're going to have a lot more people who are able to access calls. And to be clear, you know, however many million calls come in, or calls, text, chats, whatever come in, 80% are expected to be dealt with, resolved through a phone call, and 20% are going to need some sort of more. But we need to sort of, because so much of this is happening so fast, there are lots of important questions like, what sort of training are the people who are going to answer the calls get? What evidence is that training based on? How well staffed are these call centers to handle this influx? Like, a lot of the calls right now for suicide are taken by volunteers. This is not the role for a volunteer. How well will these jobs be paid? Will there be the money to do this? It is really, it's daunting to think about how many questions have to be answered, and it really epitomizes just how much of a start this is as a starting point.
Right, right. Well, Dan, can you tell us about Andrea, who was featured in your show?
Sure. So Andrea, I won't say too much about Andrea, at least to start, but back in 2012, Andrea was really struggling. She's one of millions of Americans who was not getting any treatment at all. Untreated childhood trauma had led her to experiment with pills, and then she started using crack, and then she ultimately used heroin. And we can play some tape that talks about that one particular day for her here. Andrea's crisis began in an alley in Huntington, West Virginia.
I wake up and I'm terrified.
She'd just been revived by paramedics after overdosing on heroin. All her usual thoughts tumbled through her mind that June morning in 2012. Am I going to be arrested? How am I going to get my next fix? And a new idea.
I could choose to not be here.
Her sons were 10 and 12. Andrea had vowed to never take her life. That's how her mom, Dinah, had died. Andrea had never forgiven her for that, but today the idea of suicide seemed to fit.
And that scared me. It scared me to death.
Andrea's life had ended up a lot like Dinah's in nearly every other way. Poverty, addiction, homelessness, drifting in and out of her kids' lives. Andrea wandered around all day, haunted by thoughts of her mom and scared of what she might do to herself. In the evening, she camped out in an abandoned house.
It's cold, it's middle of the night, and it's pitch black, and I'm alone.
Shaking from withdrawal, Andrea made a decision. She would kill herself.
My kids would not have to suffer and be embarrassed and ashamed and neglected and abandoned by the person that they should be able to depend on the most. And it was that moment of clarity. As soon as that thought crossed my mind, it just clicked. Oh, Mom. Poor thing. Now I understand how you made the decision that you made. Bless your heart. The anger and the resentment disappeared in that moment. And I could only feel so sad that that was her only way out.
And Dan, how did Andrea get through this?
Andrea had, she had an insight, Miriam. She had lived with the hurt and the pain of her mom having taken, having committed suicide. And she understood, as we put it in the script, the long tail of suicide, the guilt, the hurt, the unanswerable questions. And I think that night in that house, she thought about her two boys. And she didn't want her two boys to go through what she had gone through. And so she decided not to do it. And we can play the next clip here. Andrea changed her mind, but she knew she needed help fast. She considered calling 911, but worried she'd end up in jail. She thought of only one other option.
525-7851.
A place in town where she could detox for a few days. It was the help she could find, not the help she needed. She did detox for 48 hours, but stayed addicted to heroin for 5 more years. Andrea got sober in 2017. She was 41, the same age as Dinah was when she died by suicide. Andrea is 46 now and deeply involved in the local recovery community. She remembers everyone in the crowd she ran with had memorized that same number for the local detox center.
Nobody in the history of addiction has ever been shooting heroin in their jugular and thinking, this is great. You know, you got 8 people in a living room of somebody's house sharing a needle, doing a little tiny bit of stuff so you're not sick. We're all miserable. And the conversation is always, always, how are we going to get away from this? How are we going to get better? How am I going to get the help that I need?
Providing people the help that they need in the moments they need it most is the highest hope for this new 988 number. But as is so often the case with healthcare programs and policies, the difference between high hopes and disappointment will be in the details.
And I do want to mention for our listeners, if anyone is dealing with any of these issues, we do have the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It is 800-273-8255. Again, it's 800-273-8255. Dan, it's a very heavy story. What did you learn from this, and how did you deal with this topic?
Well, you know, I think Leslie Walker, our senior producer, and I, who worked on this episode, thought long and hard about how to frame Andrea's story, and we're so appreciative and thankful that she was so willing to share this experience with us. And we framed it like this. We thought that her story illustrated two things about a person in a mental health emergency, which we thought would be valuable to try to help people understand why 988 and get 988 functioning well matters. And one is that these crises can strike without warning so quickly. And the second point is, like, they're tenuous and potent. You know, it's like this rare chance to help someone get something that they need, or it could become a missed opportunity, and the consequences couldn't be any higher. And so we really wanted to illustrate that and drive that point home. And I think we did. And I just want to share, you know, Andrea got in touch with us, with Trade-Offs, after this story ran. She's in touch with, she and her sons are very close today. Something that was not included in the story was that the boy's father, Andrea's husband, several years after 2012, did commit suicide. And Andrea wrote to us, and she said she listened to the story for the first time with her and her sons in their car. And she said, "I never thought by sharing my mother's story, I'd be able to help my sons cope with their own father's suicide." And, you know, I've been a journalist for 20 years, and it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever gotten to hear back in my life. You try to do the best you can by putting good information out. And if you can do something that helps people heal a little bit, helps give people a little bit more perspective on what matters, then I think you're doing a good job.
And we appreciate all that you're doing. I mean, I think this is a great program, just to shed light on the many various things that are happening. And Brian, as we get ready to wrap up here, what is next for the show? I mean, what's the next topic coming up?
Sure. So we're going to be doing more on 988 in the coming months. So definitely, you know, this is a big topic that we'll be touching on more. But kind of the stories that are coming up most next on the list this week, we're going to be talking about something called Cascades of Care, which is, you know, you go to the doctor and you get a test. And usually we all assume, like, oh, you know, the doctor says we need a test, you know, must be a good idea. What could it hurt? But this, the research that we talk about in the story and the stories that we share, shed light that there are actually some times where that initial test is not likely to be that useful and can actually lead to a whole bunch more tests and procedures that can cause harm, physical, financial, psychological harm. And we're also going to be doing some stories coming up on Medicaid and some changes coming to Medicaid under the Biden administration.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time today. Ryan Levy, reporter and producer for the show Trade-Offs, and Dan Gorenstein, founder and executive editor of the Trade-Offs podcast. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.